economic scientists put it. The foundation, which will thus come into existence after 4 years of bitter struggle, is a far cry from the hopes of many scientists. Even without support from the National Science Foundation, of course, social science research proceeded. Political scientists supplied survey methods to the study of American politics and relied on the results to make policy recommendations. In 1950, when the distance between the parties was smaller than it had been either before or since, and voters had a hard time figuring out which party was conservative and which liberal, the American Political Science Association's Committee on Political Parties issued a report called Toward a More Responsible Two-Party System. The problem with American democracy, the committee argued, is that the parties are too alike and too weak. The report recommended strengthening every element of the party system, from national leadership committees to congressional caucuses, as well as establishing a starker difference between the party platforms. If the two parties do not develop alternative programs that can be executed, the committee warned, the voters' frustration and the mounting ambiguities of national policy might set in motion more extreme tendencies to the political left and the political right. The recommendation of political scientists that American voters ought to become more partisan and more polarized did not sit well with everyone. In 1950, in a series of lectures at Princeton, Thomas Dewey, still reeling from his unexpected loss to Truman, damned scholars who want to drive all moderates and liberals out of the Republican Party and then have the remainder join forces with the conservative groups of the South. Then they would have everything neatly arranged. Indeed, the Democratic Party would be the liberal to radical party. The Republican Party would be the conservative to reactionary party. The results would be neatly arranged, too. The Republicans would lose every election and the Democrats would win every election. Exactly this kind of sorting did eventually come to pass, not to the favor of one party or the other, but instead to the detriment of everyone. It may have been the brainchild of quantitative political scientists, but it was implemented by pollsters and political consultants using computers to segment the electorate. The questions raised by Bloomer and Rogers went unanswered. Any pollster might have predicted it. Pollsters defeat scholars. When Truman beat Dewey and not the reverse, and Democrats regained control of both houses, and long-eared Lyndon B. Johnson took a seat in the Senate, the American Medical Association panicked and telephoned the San Francisco offices of Campaigns, Inc. In a message to Congress shortly before his inauguration, Truman called for the passage of his national health insurance plan. The AMA, knowing how stunningly Campaigns, Inc. had defeated Warren's health care plan in California, decided to do exactly what the California Medical Association had done, retain Clem Whitaker and Leon Baxter. The Washington Post suggested that maybe the AMA, at the hands of Whitaker and Baxter, ought to stop whipping itself into neurosis and attempting to terrorize the whole American public every time the administration proposes a welfare department or a health program. But the Doctors Association, undaunted, hired Whitaker and Baxter for a fee of $100,000 a year with an annual budget of more than $1 million. Campaigns, Inc. relocated to a new national headquarters in Chicago with a staff of 37. To defeat Truman's proposal, they launched a national education campaign. The AMA raised $3.5 million by assessing $25 a year from its members. Whitaker and Baxter liked to talk about their work as grassroots campaigning. Not everyone was convinced. "Dear sirs," one doctor wrote to them in 1949, "is it $2.5 or $3.5 million you've allotted for your grassroots lobby?" They started, as always, by drafting a plan of campaign. "This must be a campaign to arouse and alert the American people in every walk of life until it generates a great public crusade and a fundamental fight for freedom," it began. "Any other plan of action, in view of the drift toward socialization and despotism all over the world, would invite disaster." Then, in an especially cunning maneuver aimed in part at silencing the firm's critics, Whitaker had hundreds of thousands of copies of their plan, a simplified blueprint of the campaign against compulsory health insurance, printed on blue paper to remind Americans what they ought to do was to buy Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and distributed it to reporters and editors, and to every member of Congress. The simplified blueprint wasn't their actual plan. A different plan of campaign circulated inside the office, in typescript marked confidential, not for publication. While the immediate objective of the campaign was to defeat Truman's proposal, its long-term objective was to put a permanent stop to the agitation for socialized medicine in this country by A. Awakening the people to the danger of a politically controlled, government-regulated health system. B. Convincing the people of the superior advantages of private medicine, as practiced in America, over the state-dominated medical system of other countries. C. Stimulating the growth of voluntary health insurance systems to take the economic shock out of illness and increase the availability of medical care to the American people. as Whitaker and Baxter put it. Basically, the issue is whether we are to remain a free nation, in which the individual can work out his own destiny, or whether we are to take one of the final steps toward becoming a socialist or communist state. We have to paint the picture in vivid verbiage that no one can misunderstand of Germany, Russia, and finally, England. They mailed leaflets, postcards, and letters across the country, though they were not always well met. "Received your scare letter, and how pitiful," an angry pharmacist wrote from New York. "I do hope President Truman has his way. Good luck to him." Truman could have used some luck. Whitaker and Baxter's campaign to defeat his national health insurance plan ended up costing the AMA nearly $5 million and took more than 3 years. But it worked. Truman was furious. As to what in his plan could possibly be construed as socialized medicine, he said, he didn't know what in the Sam Hill that could be. He had one more thing to say. There was nothing in this bill that came any closer to socialism than the payments the American Medical Association makes to the advertising firm of Whitaker and Baxter to misrepresent my health program. National health insurance would have to wait for another president, another Congress, and another day. The fight would only get uglier. 3. Most political careers follow an arithmetic curve. Richard Nixon's rise was exponential. Elected to Congress at 33, he won a Senate seat at 36. 2 years later, he would be elected vice president. He'd persisted in investigating Whitaker Chambers' claim that Alger Hiss had been a communist. In a series of twists and turns worthy of a Hitchcock film, including microfilm hidden in a hollowed-out pumpkin on Chambers' Maryland farm, the so-called Pumpkin Papers, Nixon charged that Hiss had been not only a communist, but, like Chambers, a Soviet spy. In January 1950, Hiss was convicted of perjury for denying that he had been a communist. The statute of limitations for espionage had expired, and sentenced to 5 years in prison. 5 days after the verdict, on the 26th, Nixon delivered a four-hour speech on the floor of Congress, a lecture he called The Hiss Case, A Lesson for the American People. It read like an Arthur Conan Doyle story, recounting the entire history of the investigation, with Nixon as ace detective. Making a bid for a Senate seat, Nixon had the speech printed and mailed copies to California voters. Nixon sought the Senate seat of longtime California Democrat Sheridan Downey, the Downey of the Uppie and Downey epic gubernatorial ticket of 1933, who had decided not to run for re-election. Nixon defeated his opponent, Democrat Helen Gehagan Douglas, by red-baiting and innuendo-dropping. Douglas, he said, was pink right down to her underwear. The nation's Carrie McWilliams said Nixon had an astonishing capacity for petty malice. But what won him the seat was the national reputation he'd earned in his prosecution of Alger Hiss, even if that crusade was soon taken over by a former heavyweight boxer who stood 6 foot tall and weighed 200 pounds. On February 9th, a junior senator from Wisconsin named Joseph McCarthy stole whole paragraphs from Nixon's The Hiss Case, A Lesson for the American People, and used them in an address of his own, in which he claimed to have a list of subversives working for the State Department. In a nod to Nixon, McCarthy liked to say, when he was snuffing out a subversive, "I have found a pumpkin." McCarthy had big hands and bushy eyebrows and an unnerving stare. During the war, he'd served as a Marine in the Pacific. Although he'd seen little combat and sustained an injury only during a hazing episode, he defeated the popular incumbent, Robert La Follette, Jr., in a 1946 Republican primary by running as a war hero, and had won a Senate seat against the Democrat, Howard McMurray, by claiming falsely that McMurray's campaign was funded by communists, as if McMurray wore pink underwear, too. The first years of McCarthy's term in the Senate had been marked by failure and duplicity. Like Nixon, he tested the prevailing political winds and decided to make his mark by crusading against communism. In his Hiss speech, Nixon had hinted that not only Hiss, but many other people in the State Department and in other parts of the Truman administration were part of a vast communist conspiracy. When McCarthy delivered his February 9th speech before the Ohio County Republican Women's Club in Wheeling, West Virginia, he went further than Nixon. "Well, I cannot take time to name all of the men in the State Department who have been named as members of the Communist Party," he said. "I have here in my hand a list of 205 names that were made known to the Secretary of State as members of the Communist Party and who nevertheless are still working and shaping the policy of the State Department." He had no list. He had nothing but imaginary pink underwear. 3 weeks after McCarthy's Wheeling address, John Purifoy, Deputy Undersecretary of State, said that while there weren't any communists in the State Department, there were 91 men, homosexuals, who'd recently been fired because they were deemed to be security risks. Another euphemism was men whose habits make them especially vulnerable to blackmail. It was in part Purifoy's statement that gave credibility to McCarthy's charges. People really had been fired. One representative from Illinois, getting the chronology all wrong, praised McCarthy for the purge. He has forced the State Department to fire 91 sex perverts. The purge had begun years earlier in 1947, under the terms of a set of security principles provided to the Secretary of State. People known for habitual drunkenness, sexual perversion, moral turpitude, financial irresponsibility, or criminal record were to be fired or screened out of the hiring process. 31 homosexuals had been fired from the State Department in 1947, 28 in 1948, and 31 in 1949. A week after Purifoy's statement, Roy Blick, the ambitious head of the Washington, D.C. Vice Squad, testified during classified hearings on the infiltration of subversives and moral perverts into the executive branch of the United States government that there were 5,000 homosexuals in Washington. Of these, Blick said, nearly 4,000 worked for the federal government. The story was leaked to the press. Blick called for a national task force. There is a need in this country for a central bureau for records of homosexuals and perverts of all types. The Nixon-McCarthy campaign against communists can't be separated from the campaign against homosexuals. There had been much intimation that Chambers, a gay man, had informed on Hiss because of a spurned romantic overture. By March of 1950, McCarthy's charges had been reported in newspapers all over the country. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee convened hearings into whether persons who are disloyal to the United States are or have ever been employed by the Department of State. The hearings, chaired by Millard Tidings, a Democrat from Maryland, proved unilluminating. In the committee's final report, Tidings called the charges a fraud and a hoax. This neither dimmed the furor nor daunted McCarthy, who masterfully manipulated the press and escalated fears of a worldwide communist conspiracy and a worldwide network of homosexuals, both trying to undermine Americanism. So great was McCarthy's hold on the electorate that for challenging him, Tidings was defeated when he ran for re-election. Who could rein him in? Few critics of McCarthyism were as forceful as Maine Senator Margaret Chase Smith, the first woman to serve in both houses of Congress. In June 1950, she rose to speak on the floor of the Senate to deliver a speech later known as the Declaration of Conscience. "I don't want to see the Republican Party ride to political victory on the four horsemen of calumny, fear, ignorance, bigotry, and smear," said Smith, a moderate Republican in the mold of Wendell Willkie. Bernard Baruch said that if a man had made that speech, he would be the next president of the United States. Later, after Smith was jettisoned from the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, it was Nixon who took her place. In September 1950, Congress passed the Internal Security Act over Truman's veto, requiring communists to register with the Attorney General and establishing a loyalty board to review federal employees. That fall, Margaret Chase Smith, who despite her centrist leanings had no qualms about the purging of homosexuals, joined North Carolina Senator Clyde Hoey's investigation into the employment of homosexuals and other sex perverts in government. The Hoey Committee's conclusion was that such men and women were a threat to national security. The crusade, at once against communists and homosexuals, was also a campaign against intellectuals in the federal government, derided as eggheads. The term, inspired by the balding Illinois Democrat Adlai Stevenson, was coined in 1952 by Louis Bromfield to describe a person of spurious intellectual pretensions, often a professor or the protege of a professor, fundamentally superficial, over-emotional, and feminine in reactions to any problems. The term connoted as well a vague homosexuality. One congressman described leftover New Dealers as short-haired women and long-haired men messing into everybody's personal affairs and lives. One thing McCarthyism was not was a measured response to communism in the United States. Membership in the Communist Party in the United States was the lowest it had been since the 1920s. In 1950, when the population of the United States stood at 150 million, there were 43,000 party members. In 1951, there were only 32,000. The Communist Party was considerably stronger in, for instance, Italy, France, and Great Britain, but none of those nations experienced a Red Scare in the 1950s. In 1954, Winston Churchill, asked to establish a royal commission to investigate communism in Great Britain, refused. In 1951, McCarthy's crusade scored a crucial legal victory when the Supreme Court upheld the Smith Act of 1940, ruling 6-2 in Dennis v. United States that First Amendment protections of free speech, press, and assembly did not extend to communists. This decision gave the Justice Department a free hand in rounding up communists who could be convicted and sentenced to prison. In a pained dissent in Dennis, Justice Hugo Black wrote, There is hope, however, that in calmer times, when present pressures, passions, and fears subside, this or some later court will restore the First Amendment liberties to the high, preferred place where they belong in a free society. That calm did not come for a very long time. Instead, McCarthy's imagined web of conspiracy grew bigger and stretched further. The Democratic Party itself, he said, was in the hands of men and women who have bent to the whispered pleas from the lips of traitors. William Jenner, a Republican senator from Indiana, said, "Our only choice is to impeach President Truman and find out who is the secret invisible government." Eggheads or not, Democrats failed to defeat McCarthyism. Lyndon Johnson had become the Democratic Party whip in 1950, and 2 years later its minority leader. The morning after the 1952 election, he'd called newly elected Democrats before sunrise to get their support. "The guy must never sleep," said a bewildered John F. Kennedy. Johnson became famous for wrangling senators the way a cowboy wrangles cattle. He'd corner them in hallways and lean over them, giving them what a pair of newspaper columnists called the treatment. "Its velocity was breathtaking, and it was all in one direction," they wrote. "He moved in close, his face a scant millimeter from his target, his eyes widening and narrowing, his eyebrows rising and falling." Johnson despised McCarthy. "Can't tie his goddamn shoes," he said. But lacking enough support to stop him, Johnson bided his time. Liberal intellectuals, refusing to recognize the right-wing's grip on the American imagination, tended to dismiss McCarthyism as an aberration, a strange eddy in a sea of liberalism. The historian Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., writing in 1949, argued that liberals, having been chastened by their earlier delusions about socialism and even Sovietism, and their romantic attachment to the ordinary and the everyday, had found their way again to the vital center of American politics. Conservatives might be cranks and demagogues, they might have power and even radio programs, but in the world of ideas, liberal thinkers believed, liberalism had virtually no opposition. In the United States at this time, liberalism is not only the dominant, but even the sole intellectual tradition, insisted literary critic Lionel Trilling. For it is the plain fact that nowadays there are no conservative or reactionary ideas in general circulation. This assessment was an error. McCarthyism wasn't an eddy. It was part of a rising tide of American conservatism. Its leading thinkers were refugees from fascist or communist regimes. They opposed collectivism and centralized planning and celebrated personal liberty, individual rights, and the free market. Ayn Rand, born Alicia Rosenbaum, grew up in Bolshevik Russia, moved to the United States in 1926, and went to Hollywood to write screenplays, eventually turning to novels. The Fountainhead appeared in 1943, and Atlas Shrugged in 1957. Austrian-born Friedrich von Hayek, after nearly 20 years at the London School of Economics, began teaching at the University of Chicago in 1949. In 1961, he moved to Germany. While engaged in vastly different projects, Hayek and Rand engaged in many of the same rhetorical moves as Whitaker and Baxter, who, like all the most effective Cold Warriors, reduced policy issues like healthcare coverage to a battle between freedom and slavery. Whitaker and Baxter's rhetoric against Truman's healthcare plan sounded the same notes as Hayek's road to serfdom. "The facts," Whitaker said in 1949, "were these. Hitler and Stalin and the socialist government of Great Britain all have used the opiate of socialized medicine to deaden the pain of lost liberty and lull the people into non-resistance. Old world contagion of compulsory health insurance, if allowed to spread to our new world, will mark the beginning of the end of free institutions in America. It will only be a question of time until the railroads, the steel mills, the power industry, the banks, and the farming industry are nationalized." To pass healthcare legislation would be to reduce America to a slave state. But perhaps the most influential of the new conservative intellectuals was Richard M. Weaver, a Southerner who taught at the University of Chicago, and whose complaint about modernity was that facts had replaced truth. Weaver's Ideas Have Consequences, 1948, rejected the idea of machine-driven progress, a point of view he labeled hysterical optimism, and argued that Western civilization had been in decline for centuries. Weaver dated the beginning of the decline to the 14th century, and the denial that there exists a universal truth, a truth higher than man. "The denial of universals carries with it the denial of everything transcending experience," Weaver wrote. "The denial of everything transcending experience means inevitably, though ways are found to hedge on this, the denial of truth. The only way to answer the question, are things getting better or are they getting worse, is to discover whether modern man knows more or is wiser than his ancestors," Weaver argued. And his answer to this question was no. With the scientific revolution, facts, particular explanations for how the world works, had replaced truth, a general understanding of the meaning of its existence. More people could read, Weaver stipulated, But in a society where expression is free and popularity is rewarded, they read mostly that which debauches them, and they are continuously exposed to manipulation by controllers of the printing machine. Machines were for Weaver no measure of progress, but instead a splendid efflorescence of decay. In place of distinction and hierarchy, Americans vaunted equality, a poor substitute. If Weaver was conservatism's most serious thinker, nothing better marked the rising popular tide of the movement than the publication in 1951 of William F. Buckley, Jr.'s God and Man at Yale, The Superstitions of Academic Freedom, in which Buckley expressed regret over the liberalism of the American university. Faculty, he said, preached anti-capitalism, secularism, and collectivism. Buckley, the sixth of 10 children, raised in a devout Catholic family, became a national celebrity, not least because of his extraordinary intellectual poise. Russell Kirk's The Conservative Mind appeared in 1953. Kirk, an intellectual historian from Michigan, provided a manifesto for an emerging movement, a story of its origins. The Conservative Mind described itself as a prolonged essay in definition, an attempt at explaining the ideas that have sustained men of conservative impulse in their resistance against radical theories and social transformations ever since the beginning of the French Revolution. The liberal, Kirk argued, sees a world that damns tradition, exalts equality, and welcomes changes. Liberalism produces a world smudged by industrialism, standardized by the masses, consolidated by government. Taking his inspiration from Edmund Burke, Kirk urged those who disagreed with liberalism's fundamental tenets to call themselves conservatives rather than classical liberals in the 19th century laissez-faire sense. The conservative, he argued, knows that civilized society requires orders and classes, believes that man has an evil nature and therefore must control his will and appetite, and that tradition provides a check on man's anarchic impulse. Conservatism requires, among other things, celebrating the mystery of human existence. The battle, then, was a battle not so much for the soul of America as for the mind of America, for mystery over facts, for hierarchy over equality, for the past over the present. In 1955, Buckley founded the National Review. Whitaker Chambers joined the staff 2 years later. Kirk, who decried the ritualistic liberalism of American newspapers and magazines, contributed a regular column. In the first issue, Buckley said that the magazine stands athwart history, yelling, "Stop!" But if it was chiefly men who advanced the ideas and wrote the books of the new conservatism, it was women who carried the placards and worked in the precincts, not yelling, but politely whispering, "Stop, please." Betty Farrington, head of the National Federation of Republican Women's Clubs, filled those clubs with housewives who were ardent in their opposition to communism and support of McCarthy. After Dewey lost in 1948, Farrington had argued that the GOP needed a strong man. "How thankful we would have been if a leader had appeared to show us the path to the promised land of our hope. The world needs such a man today. He is certain to come sooner or later, but we cannot sit idly by in the hope of his coming. Besides, his advent depends partly on us. The mere fact that a leader is needed does not guarantee his appearance. People must be ready for him, and we, as Republican women in our clubs, prepare for him." Farrington believed McCarthy was that man. It's no accident that McCarthy's Wheeling, West Virginia speech was an address made by invitation to a Republican women's club, nor that his language was the language of the 19th century female crusade. The great difference between our Western Christian world and the atheistic communist world is not political, it is moral, McCarthy said. Temperance, abolition, suffrage, populism, and prohibition weren't part of Russell Kirk's intellectual genealogy of conservatism, but they were the foundational experiences of its core constituency. Housewives were, to the Republican Party infrastructure, what labor union members were to the Democrats. "If it were not for the National Federation of Republican Women, there would not be a Republican Party," Barry Goldwater admitted. Nixon couldn't stand them. "I will not go and talk to those shitty-ass old ladies," he'd fume. All the same, gritting his teeth, he went. By the 1950s, a majority of GOP activists were women, compared to 41% of Democratic Party activists. In 1950, Farrington launched the School of Politics, 3-day sessions in Washington to train precinct workers. The sessions were open to men and women, but most who attended were women. Well, at the same sort of sessions run by the DNC, most attendees were men. In the GOP, party work was women's work, work that the party explained, structured, and justified by calling it housework. Republican Party aspirants were told to be proud of the women who work on the home front, ringing the doorbells, filling out registration cards, and generally doing the housework of government, so that the principles of the Republican Party can be brought to every home. Republican women established kitchen cabinets, appointing a female equivalent to every member of the president's cabinet, who shared political recipes on GOP accomplishments with the housewives in the nation by way of monthly bulletins on what's cooking in Washington. As a senator speaking to the Federation of Women's Clubs suggested, the elephant was the right symbol for the GOP because an elephant has a vacuum cleaner in front and a rug beater behind. By the mid-1950s, the conservative critique of the academy as godless and of the press as mindless were in place, along with a defense of the family and of women's role as housewives, however politicized the role of housewife had become. A moral crusade against homosexuality and in favor of a newly imagined traditional family had begun. Meanwhile, McCarthyism abided, mean-spirited, vulgar, and unhinged. McCarthy's rise, the lunacy of his conspiracy theory, and the size of his following struck many observers as a symptom of a disease at the very heart of American politics. It left George Kennan with a lasting doubt. A political system and a public opinion, it seemed to me, that could be so easily disoriented by this sort of challenge in one epoch would be no less vulnerable to similar ones in another. What had made so many Americans so vulnerable to such an implausible view of the world? Inside CBS, the plan was known as Project X. It was top secret until, a month before Election Day in 1952, the television network announced that it would predict the winner using a giant brain. One local station took out a newspaper ad promising that a robot computer will give CBS the fastest reporting in history. That giant brain was called UNIVAC, the Universal Automatic Computer, and it was the first commercial computer in the history of the world. In May 1951, John Mauchly and Presper Eckert, who'd unveiled ENIAC in 1946, invited members of the press to a demonstration of their new machine. They'd built it for the U.S. Census Bureau. Half the size of ENIAC, UNIVAC was even faster. This lickety-split sorting of the population would prove invaluable to the Census Bureau. Soon, all calculations relating to the federal census were completed by UNIVAC, work that was called data processing. Commercially applied, UNIVAC and its heirs would transform American business, straightaway cutting costs and accelerating production by streamlining managerial and administrative tasks, such as payroll and inventory, and eventually turning people into consumers whose habits could be tracked and whose spending could be calculated and even predicted. Politically, it would wreak havoc, splitting the electorate into so many atoms. The technology that made it possible to sort citizens by sex, marital status, education, residence, age group, birthplace, employment, income, and a dozen other classifications would make it possible to sort consumers, too. Businesses found that they could both reduce prices and increase profits by sorting markets into segments and pitching the right ad and product to exactly the right consumer. In much the same way that advertisers segmented markets, political consultants would sort voters into different piles, too, and send them different messages. When Mauchly and Eckert staged their unveiling in 1951, all of this was in the future, and the press was not excited. In a one-paragraph story on the bottom of page 25, the New York Times only dutifully took notice of the 8-foot-tall mathematical genius, as if it were nothing more than a stunt, like Electro the Moto Man. UNIVAC made its debut at a moment when Americans were increasingly exasperated by automation. The very year that readers waded through White Collar, the sociologist C. Wright Mills's indictment of the fate of people who worked surrounded by telephones and dictaphones, intercoms and mimeographs, in fluorescent-lit air-conditioned offices, in steel and glass skyscrapers, or in suburban office parks. Mills argued that machine-driven office work had created a class of desperately alienated workers, and that the new office, for all its gadgets, was no less horrible than the old factories of brick and steam. Seeing the big stretch of office space with rows of identical desks, Mills wrote, one is reminded of Herman Melville's description of a 19th-century factory. At rows of blank-looking counters, at rows of blank-looking girls with blank white folders in their blank hands, all blankly folding blank paper. Melville had been describing a New England paper mill in 1855. Mills described a modern office a century later. The new office is rationalized. Machines are used. Employees become machine attendants. The work, as in the factory, is collective, not individualized, he wrote. It is specialized to the point of automation. The minutes of white-collar workers' lives were tapped out by typewriters and adding machines, having lost the capacity to feel anything except boredom. Robotic having become a term of opprobrium, The people interested in explaining the truly revolutionary capabilities of the UNIVAC had to do something more than write numbers on ping-pong balls. Mockley, disappointed at the bland coverage of UNIVAC's unveiling, wrote a paper called, "Are Computers Newsworthy?" Given that the novelty of computers as front-page news had worn off, the best approach would be to find ways to showcase their application to real-world problems, he suggested. He hired a public relations firm. "We must aim our publicity at the public in general, because our object is to expand the market until computers become as ordinary as telephone switchboards and bookkeeping machines," he explained. Mockley's PR team then came up with a very clever plan of bringing to CBS a proposal to predict the outcome of the upcoming election on live television on election night. In 1948, less than 3% of American homes had a television. By 1952, that number was up to 45%. By the end of the decade, 90% of American homes had a television. The year 1952 marked the first coverage of a presidential election by television, and if Mockley had his way, it would be the first whose result would be predicted on television. It looked to be an especially fascinating election. General Dwight D. Eisenhower, a lifelong military man, a five-star general, who during the Second World War had served as Supreme Allied Commander Europe, had refused to run in 1948, on the grounds that professional soldiers ought to abstain from political office holding. In 1952, at the age of 57, he was finally persuaded to run against Truman, an election expected to amount to a referendum on U.S. involvement in Korea. In June 1950, North Korean communist forces crossed the 38th parallel to attack South Korea. Truman sent in troops led by General Douglas MacArthur, who drove the North Koreans nearly back to the border with China. China responded by providing resources to North Korea, and the American forces lost all the ground they'd gained. The war was protracted, costly, and unpopular. Eisenhower, a hero from a better war, appeared a perfect candidate for the Times. Clem Whitaker and Leon Baxter managed his campaign. Having worked behind the scenes since its founding in 1933, Campaigns Inc. had attracted not altogether wanted attention as a consequence of its phenomenal defeat of Truman's national health insurance plan. A three-part exposé written by Carrie McWilliams had appeared in The Nation in 1951. McWilliams admired Whitaker and Baxter, but he believed that they had too much power and that they were dangerous and that what they had created was nothing less than government by Whitaker and Baxter. After McWilliams' story ran, a number of notable doctors resigned from the AMA, including the head of Massachusetts General Hospital, who explained in his letter of resignation that he was no longer willing to pay dues used to support an activity which I consider contrary to public welfare and unworthy of a learned profession. That fall, the AMA fired Whitaker and Baxter. That's when Whitaker and Baxter went to work for Eisenhower. They decided to put Ike on TV. Republicans spent $1.5 million on television advertising in 1952. Democrats spent $77,000. Polls drove the ads. Ads drove the polls. George Gallup chose the themes of Eisenhower's TV spots, which took the form of fake documentaries. In Eisenhower Answers America, a young black man plucked off the street from Times Square and reading a cue card says, "General, the Democrats are telling me I never had it so good." Eisenhower replies, "Can that be true, when America is billions in debt, when prices have doubled, when taxes break our backs, and we are still fighting in Korea?" Then he looks sternly straight into the camera. "It's tragic, and it's time for a change." Eisenhower's politics were moderate, as was his style. He described himself as a dynamic conservative, conservative when it comes to money and liberal when it comes to human beings. His Democratic opponent, Illinois Governor Adlai Stevenson, found that account of Eisenhower's political commitments wanting. "I assume what it means is that you will strongly recommend the building of a great many schools to accommodate the needs of our children, but not provide the money." Critics called the bald and effete Stevenson an egghead and fruity. Rumors spread that he was gay. "Eggheads of the world unite," Stevenson would joke. "You have nothing to lose but your yolks," not quite appreciating the malice of the campaign against him. Television became, to the 1950s, what radio had been to the 1930s. The style of news reporting that had been developed on the radio adapted poorly to the screen, but the audience was so huge that news organizations had every incentive to adapt. In 1949, the Federal Communications Commission established the Fairness Doctrine, a standard for television news that required a reasonable balance of views on any issue put before the public. CBS sent Walter Cronkite, a 35-year-old newsman from its Washington affiliate, WTOP-TV, to cover both nominating conventions. Richard Nixon went to the Republican National Convention in Chicago on board a chartered train from California called the Earl Warren Special, allegedly supporting Warren's bid for the presidential nomination. Whitaker and Baxter had never forgiven Warren for firing them in 1942, and even scuttling his statewide health insurance plan in 1945 had not slaked their thirst for vengeance. During the train ride to Chicago, Nixon secretly swayed California delegates to throw their support behind Eisenhower, a scheme forever after known as the Great Train Robbery, and the general had rewarded him with a spot on the ticket. Warren would later call Nixon a crook and a thief. Eisenhower would find a place for Warren in his administration as Solicitor General. Nixon had managed to secure the GOP vice presidential nomination, but weeks later he'd go on television to try to hold on to it. After the convention, the press revealed that Nixon had an $18,000 slush fund. Eisenhower's advisors urged him to dump Nixon and ask Nixon to step down. Nixon, facing the end of his political career, decided to make his case to the public. He labored over it, writing the speech of his life. On September 23, 1952, sitting at a pine desk with his wife looking on from a chintz chair in what appeared to be his own den but was a stage built at an NBC studio in Los Angeles, he gave a remarkable performance, pained and self-pitying. It reached the largest television audience television had ever recorded. Nixon said he intended to do something unprecedented in American politics. He would provide a full financial disclosure, an accounting of everything I've earned, everything I've spent, and everything I owe. Nearly down to the penny, he then listed his modest income, his loans, and his wealth. This will surprise you because it is so little. He had no stocks, no bonds, a 2-year-old Oldsmobile, mortgages, debts to banks, and even a debt to his parents that he was paying back every month with interest. Yes, he'd accepted gifts to a campaign fund, but no contributors had gotten special favors for their donations, and not 1 cent of the $18,000 had gone to him for his private use. He'd spent it on campaign expenses. He covered his face for a moment, as if offering up a final, humiliating confession. There was one gift he must acknowledge. A man in Texas had sent his daughters a black-and-white spotted Cocker Spaniel puppy, and his 6-year-old daughter, Tricia, had named the dog Checkers. "Regardless of what they say about it," he said, feigning injury, "we're gonna keep it." Liberals were disgusted, partly because it was something of a sham, but mostly because it was maudlin. Eisenhower was at the time president of Columbia University. 23 full professors at Columbia, including Alan Nevins, Lionel Trilling, and Richard Hofstadter, issued a statement in which they denounced the Checkers speech, which Nevins described as so essentially dishonest and emotional appeal that he confused a great many people as to the issues involved. Walter Lippmann said that watching it was one of the most demeaning experiences my country has ever had to bear. But the overwhelming majority of people who watched it loved it. Nixon spoke to their experiences and their quiet lives and to their grievances, too. Plainly, Nixon had saved his career and more. In 30 minutes, Time reported, he has changed from a liability to his party to a shining asset. Nixon had accomplished something else of greater and more lasting importance. Since the days of Harding and Hoover, the Republican Party had been the party of businessmen, of country club members and stockholders. The Democratic Party had been the party of the little guy, from Andrew Jackson's self-made man to William Jennings's Bryan's farmer to FDR's forgotten man. Nixon, with that speech, reversed this calculus. That was what so galled liberals. They were no longer the party of the people. Populism had shifted to the right. The Checkers speech was a landmark in the history of television, and it became a watchword in the history of American politics. Lost in the fog of memory was another epic turn during that election. Nixon decided after the Checkers speech that he loved television. As his friend, the Hollywood producer Ted Rogers, said, he was the electronic man. But the real electronic man of that year's political season was the UNIVAC. After the conventions, all three network television broadcasters were looking for a way to do a better job covering election night than they'd done in 1948, which had been widely seen as a dismal failure. There hadn't been much to look at. As one critic put it, counting ballots is hardly a function which lends itself to much visual excitement. Added to the clumsiness of the television coverage was the lingering embarrassment of the error of everyone's prediction of the outcome. Broadcasters had made the same error as the Dewey Beats Truman Chicago Tribune. By the time Truman pulled ahead, CBS had already closed down for the night. CBS agreed to commission UNIVAC as its special guest on election night. On November 4th, the actual UNIVAC, there was only one, was in Philadelphia, while CBS's Charles Collingwood sat at a blinking console at the network's flagship studio in New York, giving viewers the illusion that he was controlling a computer. A UNIVAC is a fabulous electronic machine which we have borrowed to help us predict this election from the basis of early returns as they come in, Collingwood told his audience as the evening's coverage began. This is not a joke or a trick, he went on. It is an experiment. We think it's going to work. We don't know. We hope it will work. 36-year-old Walter Cronkite read the early East Coast returns. Edward R. Murrow provided the commentary. Cronkite, born in Missouri, spoke with a gentlemanly Midwestern twang. Not long after the East Coast polls closed, CBS announced that Eisenhower was ahead in the popular vote, Stevenson in the electoral vote. Cronkite then said, And now, to find out perhaps what this all means, at least in the electronic age, let's turn to that electronic miracle, the electronic brain, UNIVAC, with a report from Charles Collingwood. UNIVAC had been attempting to calculate the likely outcome of the election by comparing early returns to results from the elections of 1944 and 1948. When the camera turned to Collingwood, though, he could get no answer from UNIVAC. Murrow ventured that perhaps UNIVAC was cautious. After all, it was still early in the night. It may be possible for men or machines to draw some sweeping conclusions from the returns so far, Murrow said, but I am not able to do it. But then, eyeing the returns from Connecticut, where a great many Democrats had surprisingly voted for the Republican, Murrow, while not offering a sweeping conclusion, suggested that the momentum appeared to be very much in Ike's favor. At 10:30, Cronkite turned again to Collingwood. UNIVAC was having a little bit of trouble, Collingwood said, with evident embarrassment. At one point, UNIVAC predicted that Eisenhower would win by a sizable margin, at another that Stevenson might eke out a win. After Murrow called the election for Eisenhower, UNIVAC changed its mind again and said that the race was close. Cronkite turned to Murrow, who said, I think it is now reasonably certain that this election is over. 15 minutes later, Cronkite offered this update. And now, UNIVAC, our electronic brain, which a moment ago still thought there was a 7-8 for Governor Stevenson, says that the chances are 100-1 in favor of General Eisenhower. I might note that UNIVAC is running a few moments behind Ed Murrow, however. Ike won in a landslide. UNIVAC called it right in the end, and so did George Gallup, who had gotten the vote wrong by 5% in 1948 and got it wrong by 4% again in 1952, but this time Eisenhower's margin of victory was so big that Gallup's margin of error hadn't led him to predict the wrong winner. The next day, Murrow, speaking on CBS radio, delivered a sermon about the civic importance of voting as against the political mischief of polling, political consultants, and electronic brains. Yesterday, the people surprised the pollsters, the prophets, and many politicians, Murrow said. They demonstrated, as they did in 1948, that they are mysterious and their motives are not to be measured by mechanical means. The election, he thought, had returned to the American voter his sovereignty, stolen by those who believe we are predictable. Murrow said, We are in a measure released from the petty tyranny of those who assert that they can tell us what we think, what we believe, what we will do, what we hope, and what we fear, without consulting us, all of us. Murrow's faith in the American creed and the triumph of reason over fear and progress over prophecy was a hallmark of mid-20th century liberalism. But it was also a shaken faith. Between the unreasoning McCarthy and the coldly calculating computer, where was the independent-minded American voter, weighing facts and searching for truth? The questions about the malleability of public opinion raised by radio were revisited during the rise of television. Brainwashing became a household word in the 1950s, when it was used to refer not only to the psychological torture during the Korean War, but also to the persuasive powers of television. When Americans talk about public opinion, C. Wright Mills argued, they meant the 18th century idea of informed people engaging in free, rational discussion to arrive at truth, the right understanding of an issue, before urging their representatives to take action. But in the middle of the 20th century, Mills said, this idea had become nothing more than a fairy tale, as fanciful as Disneyland, because the public of public opinion is recognized by all those who have considered it carefully as something less than it once was. Like many social scientists of his generation, Mills argued that the United States was far along the road to becoming a fully mass society rather than a community of publics. The way to tell the difference between a mass society and a community of publics is the technology of communication. A community of publics is a population of people who talk to one another. A mass society receives information from the mass media. In a mass society, elites, not the people, make most decisions long before the people know there is a decision to be made. The formation of what Mills called power elites was directly related to technological shifts, especially the rise of computing. As the means of information and of power are centralized, Mills wrote, some men come to occupy positions in American society from which they can look down upon and by their decisions mightily affect the everyday lives of ordinary men and women. Yet for all this concern about mass media, a term coined in derision, there remained sources of optimism, especially in the undeniable observation that investigative television reporting and broadcast television news were usefully informing the electorate, introducing them to candidates and issues, and helping Americans keep abreast of national and world affairs. And McCarthy's own end, after all, came on television. On February 18, 1954, McCarthy questioned General Ralph Zwicker, a holder of the Purple Heart and a Silver Star. The senator told him the general didn't have the brains of a 5-year-old child and that his testimony was a disgrace to the army. Eisenhower had long since lost patience with McCarthy and the damage he had done. But going after the army was the last straw. The next month on CBS television's See It Now, Murrow narrated an edited selection of McCarthy's speeches before the public and during congressional hearings, revealing the cruelty of the man, his moral shabbiness and pettiness, his brutality. Murrow's 30-minute presentation of evidence took the form of a carefully planned prosecution. "And upon what meat doth Senator McCarthy feed?" Murrow asked. "Two of the staples of his diet are the investigation, protected by immunity, and the half-truth." McCarthy was given an opportunity to reply, which he took up feebly 2 weeks later. Murrow closed with a sermon. "We will not walk in fear one of another," he said. "We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep into our history and our doctrine and remember that we are not descended from fearful men." 1 week after Murrow's broadcast, the Senate convened the Army McCarthy hearings to investigate charges that McCarthy's chief counsel, Roy Cohn, later Donald Trump's mentor, had attempted to obtain military preferment for another McCarthy aide, David Shine. Lyndon Johnson slyly arranged for the hearings to be televised. The hearings lasted 57 days, of which 36 were broadcast. On June 9th, when Army Chief Counsel Joseph Welch asked McCarthy if, finally, he had any decency, viewers had seen for themselves that he hadn't. Cohn resigned. Johnson, reelected by a landslide in the fall of 1954, when Democrats regained control of the Senate, decided the moment to strike had finally come. He named a special committee to investigate McCarthy and made sure the committee was dominated by conservatives so that no one could question that the investigation had been partisan. The committee recommended disciplining McCarthy. That December, the Senate voted 65-22 to censure him. John F. Kennedy, whose brother Robert worked as a McCarthy aide and whose father had long supported McCarthy, was the only Democrat not to publicly support censure. McCarthy's fall had come. "It's no longer McCarthyism," said Eisenhower. "It's McCarthy-wism." McCarthy, struggling with drinking, died 3 years later, only 48. "This country needs a revival," House Speaker Sam Rayburn said, "and I believe Billy Graham is bringing it to us." Against the godlessness of communism, before and after McCarthy's fall, Americans turned anew to religion. In the decade following the end of the war, church membership grew from 75 million to 100 million. Much of the growth was driven by Southern Baptists like Billy Graham, who asserted a growing influence on American life and politics. Between 1941 and 1961, membership in the Southern Baptist Convention doubled. In 8 days in the fall of 1949, Graham preached to more than 350,000 people in Los Angeles. Broad-shouldered and brill-creamed, Graham left audiences swooning. But he didn't only draw new members to the Southern Baptist Convention. He brought together all manner of white conservative Protestants, North and South, into a new evangelism. For Graham, the Cold War represented a Manichaean battle between Christ and communism. "Do you know that the fifth columnists, called communists, are now more rampant in Los Angeles than in any other city in America?" he demanded. "The world is divided into two camps. Communism has declared war against God, against Christ, against the Bible, and against all religion. Unless the Western world has an old-fashioned revival, we cannot last." Communists became the new infidels. Graham, who'd grown up in North Carolina, romanticized rural America, calling the shepherds of the Bible hillbillies. His anti-intellectualism aligned well with a broader critique of liberalism. "When God gets ready to shake America, he might not take the PhD and the DD and the THD. Graham preached. God may choose a country boy. God may choose a man no one knows, a hillbilly, a country boy, who will sound forth a mighty voice to America. Thus saith the Lord. Graham himself, though, traveled in powerful cosmopolitan circles. In 1950, he began praying before Congress. He held prayer meetings with senators. He met with presidents. He preached evangelism as Americanism. If you would be a loyal American, he said, then become a loyal Christian. To Graham, the tool of the enemy and of the devil was the sin of tolerance. The word tolerant means liberal, broad-minded, he said, and the easygoing compromise and tolerance that we have been taught by pseudo-liberals in almost every area of our life for years means nothing so much as appeasement to communism. My own theory about communism, he said, is that it is masterminded by Satan. As Graham's influence grew, Eisenhower came to see his lack of membership in any church as a political liability. Raised as a Mennonite, he decided to convert to Presbyterianism, becoming the first president to be baptized while in the White House. His administration inaugurated the practice of a national prayer breakfast. Our form of government has no sense unless it is founded in a deeply religious faith, and I don't care what it is, Eisenhower said. During his administration, Congress mandated the inclusion of In God We Trust on all money and added Under God to the Pledge of Allegiance. For more reasons, too, conservatives had high hopes for Eisenhower, whose 1952 campaign had included a promise to repeal New Deal taxes that he said were approaching the point of confiscation. Eisenhower's cabinet included the former president of General Motors. With Eisenhower's pro-business administration, Adlai Stevenson said, New Dealers had made way for car dealers. Eisenhower was also opposed to national health care, as was his Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, a longtime conservative Texas Democrat named Ovita Culp Hobby, who'd recently switched parties. She liked to say she'd come to Washington to bury socialized medicine. Both Eisenhower and Hobby considered free polio vaccinations socialized medicine, and Hobby argued against the free distribution of the vaccine, a position that would have exposed millions of children to the disease. In the end, after a related scandal, Hobby was forced to resign. But Eisenhower proved a disappointment to conservatives. From the start, he had his doubts about the nature of the Cold War. A decorated general, Eisenhower was nevertheless the child of pacifists who considered war a sin. And even as he oversaw a buildup of nuclear weapons, he questioned the possibility of the world surviving an atomic war. There just aren't enough bulldozers to scrape the bodies off the street, he said. Nor was he so sure that any part of the manufacture of so many weapons could possibly make any kind of sense. In his first major address as president, delivered on April 16, 1953, weeks after Stalin's death, when he may have hoped for warmer relations with the Soviet Union, he reckoned the cost of arms. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed, he said. The world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. He invoked, of all people, William Jennings Bryan and his Cross of Gold speech. This is not a way of life in any true sense, Eisenhower went on. Under the clouds of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. It was Eisenhower's best speech about the arms race, if by no means his last. We're all in agreement on the format, moderator Quincy Howe said in 1956, introducing the first ever televised debate between two presidential candidates. There's going to be a 3-minute opening statement from each of the two gentlemen here and a 5-minute closing. Radio hosts had tried fighting fascism in the 1930s by holding debates over the radio. In the 1950s, television hosts tried to fight communism and McCarthyism by doing the same on TV. Howe, a former CBS radio broadcaster, had been director of the American Civil Liberties Union. In the 1930s, he'd served as a panelist on NBC Radio's America's Town Meeting of the Air. He cared about the quality of an argument. He cherished public debate. In 1956, he served as a moderator of a debate between Adlai Stevenson and another Democratic presidential prospect, former Tennessee Senator Estes Kefauver, broadcast on ABC. The idea had come from Stevenson and his advisor, Newton Minow, later the head of the FCC. In the spirit of radio debates hosted by the League of Women Voters since the 1920s, Stevenson and Minow were convinced that television could educate American voters and model the free and open exchange of political ideas. Stevenson challenged Kefauver. Kefauver agreed, and the two men met in a 1-hour debate in a studio in Miami. In between opening and closing statements, Howe explained, he'd allow free-willing talk in which I act as a kind of traffic cop with the power to hand out parking tickets if anyone stays too long in one place or to enforce speed limits if anyone gets going too fast. The debate took place the day after the United States dropped on the Bikini Atoll, a bomb far more powerful than the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Stevenson said about the new bomb, "The future is either going to be a future of creativity and of great abundance, or it's going to be a future of total incineration, death, and destruction." The Stevenson-Kefauver debate, like the H-bomb, had been a test. The Republican National Committee chairman called the debate tired, sorry, and uninspiring. But debating his opponent didn't hurt Stevenson, who won the nomination and began making a case to the nation that presidential candidates ought to debate one another on television regularly. "I would like to propose that we transform our circus atmosphere presidential campaign into a great debate, conducted in full view of all the people," he later wrote, calling for regular half-hour debates between the major party candidates. Meanwhile, Stevenson squared off against Eisenhower and his running mate Richard Nixon, who'd drawn inward, convinced that the print press was conspiring against him, even though, for a long time, he'd been something of a media darling. The tall, dark, and yes, handsome freshman congressman who has been pressuring the House Un-American Activities Committee to search out the truth in the Chambers Hiss affair is how the Washington Post had described him at the beginning of his career. He was unquestionably one of the outstanding first-termers in the 80th Congress. All the same, newspaper columnists had badly drummed Nixon after his Checker speech, and especially after McCarthy's very bad end, and not always fairly. Syndicated newspaper columnist Drew Pearson had reported that Nixon had taken a bribe from an oil company. The report was based on a letter that turned out to be a forgery. Then there were stories that were simply unwarranted, dumb, and mean. Time had gleefully reported that Checkers was not housebroken and had not been spayed and had gotten pregnant by a neighborhood dog. Nixon, fed up, said he wanted to write a memoir called "I've Had It." But then, in September 1955, Eisenhower had a heart attack, and Nixon decided to hold on, though he had to fight for a spot on the ticket. He won that spot in San Francisco in 1956 at a Republican convention managed by Whitaker and Baxter. The key political fact about the gathering now breaking up is that it has made Richard M. Nixon the symbol, if not the center, of authority in the Republican Party, reported Richard Robert in The New Yorker. Campaigns, Inc. had teamed up with the California firm of Bouse and Ross. Whitaker and Baxter wrote the copy. Bouse and Ross produced the radio and television spots. That same season, they campaigned on behalf of Proposition 4, a ballot measure favoring the oil industry and giving them more license to drill. The measure was written by attorneys for Standard Oil. Whitaker and Baxter succeeded in getting the referendum's name changed to the Oil and Gas Conservation Act. "Political campaigns are too important to leave to politicians," Bouse and Ross said. In a 1956 campaign speech written by the economist John Kenneth Galbraith, Stevenson described Nixon land as the land of slander and scare, the land of sly innuendo, the poison pen, the anonymous phone call and hustling, pushing, shoving, the land of smash and grab and anything to win. "I want you to write the speeches against Nixon," Stevenson had written Galbraith. "You have no tendency to be fair." But Nixon land was Whitaker and Baxter land. In television ads, both the Republican and Democratic presidential campaigns of 1956 acknowledged the confusion that television advertising had itself sown. In one Republican ad, a cartoon voter despairs, "I've listened to everybody on TV and radio. I've read the papers and magazines. I've tried, but I'm still confused. Who's right? What's right? What should I believe? What are the facts? How can I tell?" A comforting narrator calms down the worried voter and convinces him to like Ike. Stevenson, in his own television ad, haplessly tried to indict what he considered the callowness and fakery of the medium by exposing the camera, cables, and lights that had been installed in a room in his house in Illinois. He wanted to save Americans from themselves by showing them how what they saw on their screens was produced. "I wish you could see what else is in this room," he said, speaking directly into the camera. "Besides the camera and the lights over here, there are cables all over the floor." The ad is positively postmodern, self-conscious, uncertain, and troubling. "Thanks to television, I can talk to millions of people that I couldn't reach any other way," Stevenson said, and then he quavered. "I can talk to you, yes, but I can't listen to you. I can't hear about your problems. To do that, I've got to go out and see you in person." But when Stevenson did go out on the campaign trail, he proved unpersuasive. In Los Angeles, speaking before a primarily black audience, he was booed when he said, "We must proceed gradually, not upsetting habits or traditions that are older than the Republic." In 1952, Eisenhower had beaten Stevenson in the Electoral College 442-89. In 1956,